TFM.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 234. When you orb an orb, anything is possible. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Larry Nemechek. As we end an unprecedented 48 consecutive weeks of Star Trek content, Larry and I dust off the orange sofa, plug in the mics, and take a look at the state of the franchise in 2022. We discuss each of the modern series and imagine what series might be on the horizon. We also debate the pros and cons of the streaming model for storytelling and talk about how Star Trek and Star Wars are pushing each other forward. There's a lot to talk about, so let's step into the Ready Room. Larry, what are you doing here? Have you been hanging out with Jean-Luc Picard again into some temporal hijinks? I mean, we have not been in this Ready Room together in quite a while, and yet you're still here.
Well, apparently there's time travel going on because I keep hearing people pronounce the word as temporal, and it drives me up the wall. People have no idea about time traveling in Star Trek and don't know about the, you know, the temporal prime directive or anything.
Well, the best way to find out what's happening is to check your temporal sensors.
Yes, yes. And I've, you know, or just go to some Asian restaurant somewhere and have a nice bowl of tempura. But that's what it reminds me.
Oh, man.
No, it has been a long while. And I feel like all 47 Star Trek series on the air now have all flown by.
Well, the 47 that they're producing have flown by, and the 47 new ones that Kurtzman's working on apparently are moving along quite well.
It's been a long road getting from here to there, but there's more road to come. So yes,
there is a lot.
I can't believe it's been so long since we were on a mic talking, though. That's the main thing.
It has been a long time because of you. You're very active all the time, but because of me, work, it has been very difficult to juggle podcasting, and Matthew and I have put all of our available time into Saddle Up with Strange New Worlds, and before that, The Artificial Tango with Picard, and fitting in a few orbs here and there. So the Ready Room here has been vacant for a little while.
It has been. And we're going to tackle a lot of broad strokes here tonight, but
we're going to tackle it all tonight.
We're going to tackle.
Yeah, this is going to be.
You know, I talk about things on Tuesdays Live, but I don't always talk about things on the nose. And sometimes I've been a guest on some other shows, and we talk about an episode or a season or something. But I haven't gotten the chance to really dive deep into anything. I'm going to start a new little series of my own called Second Opinion, where I kind of do that. I kind of like do a quick reaction once we get back to fresh episodes or to a headline, but still, I don't get to do these long form deep dives very often. So let's dive in like it's a Cetacean Ops, and we've got the belugas on the Cerritos.
I'm a little bit worried about swimming with those belugas because I don't know where their flippers are going to go. You know, they seem a little perky.
They're a little frisky, but at least they run a clean pool. No,
right.
No dirty tennis shoes, no dirty boots.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. So you and I, from time to time over the years, we have done these episodes of the Ready Room where we just look at the state of the franchise as we go through these transitions, and we haven't done it in a while. And so I thought that that's what we can do today, the state of Star Trek in 2022, because we've just ended this run of, was it four? How many weeks was it? Like 49 weeks or something like that, right?
People were arguing about 47, 48, 49. It was too good to be 47. So something like that.
Yeah. Of just new Star Trek every week, which we had not had. Well, I don't think we've ever had
that many consecutive weeks of Star Trek, even back in the golden age, right?
Nope, because you would have a break for holidays.
Right.
You would never get that
and
many.
Summer break and so forth. So,
right.
So we've just ended this run, and we've had show after show after show end its season, and now we've got new stuff on the horizons. And you just came back from San Diego Comic-Con, so you were able to gauge the mood of the fans who braved the elements and went out into meet space into these fabled in-person gatherings that I hear still exist.
Are you saying the meet M-E-E-T space or the M-E-A-T space? Because
this is the M-E-A-T, you know, the cyberspace versus meet space vocabulary here.
Okay, because
but
I think
meet space with two E's also works well.
Oh, okay. Well, the M-E-A-T space is very true, especially from the COVID BA5 variant perspective. Lots of meat out there to jump into. So, but I have to say, this is amazing. They do have, and it was not the case. This is California, but it was still a county beside. It's a very conscientious county, but LA County is the only county that's talking about returning to indoor masking. San Diego County hasn't talked about it and didn't, but the Comic-Con itself did have that as a requirement for entry, which they were allowed to do. And to their credit, and I want to say this about sci-fi fandom in general, especially Star Trek, because, you know, we're the franchise of Spock and Data. Data and Spock, both with capital letters. That it's beginning with the return at Vegas last year at half speed, half numbers. People were, I want to say compliant, but I'm not saying that they're sheep. I mean, people got it. There's a rationality base there. And the people that had an issue stayed home, I think. There was either fear of COVID or maybe anger at the masking. But one of the two, there were no issues. And I've never really seen issues at any of the small conventions that started to reopen with some confidence and then had to back off a little. And so to have Comic-Con, I'll just say, they normally say 150,000 badges. Now, I heard 180 because of the exhibitors and the hangers-on and the wannabes and the entourages and the talent that just comes in, you know, and leaves. So apparently they're still saying 150. I had thought it was 180. But they made the decision to cut it by 10%. So they only offered 135,000 badges, which still sounds like an insane amount of people. But when you're there, everything did feel throttled back. They've also made an effort. In the beginning, it was just for sanity, and then it helped for the COVID. They made a big effort to spread things out to other venues, some of the hotels, not the convention center, some of the gas lamp, like take over a restaurant, you know, and rebrand it kind of thing. Use things like theaters and libraries as program spaces. So something as huge as San Diego Comic-Con, the granddaddy Comic-Con, I was amazed to see how much was going on. So I have no doubt there'll be some COVID bounce out of that.
But, yeah. Well, I'm sure you'll be fine, Larry. And if you're not, Dr. Mbengue will take care of you. And if he can't help you, he can just put you in the transport buffer until next year. So,
you know, it gives a whole new, for those old enough to remember this, because I'm just realizing it's been probably about 20 years since it was on the market, maybe. It gives a whole new meaning to take a buffer in and call me in the morning.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. So, okay, so it sounds like the convention was as safe as it could be under the circumstances. But what was the mood of the fans there? Because people have gotten used to not meeting in person, but now finally they can come back and there's so much activity in the Star Trek universe to talk about.
The mood of everybody, it was because the density of people were down because of COVID, people seemed to be in kind of a lighter mood and like, oh my, oh, look at this. And, you know, it just felt lighter. And the floor felt lighter. The panels felt lighter to go to. So the Hall H moment, I talked about this today on Tuesday's Live. Two things struck me about Star Trek fans and this. Number one, the Hall H moment was huger than ever. That hour and a half, they ran through three series. We can talk about that in a minute. But also, because led by Picard being LA-based, right? But even with the Toronto shows. And I say that, you know, the animation, Lower Decks and Prodigy, both the writers and a chunk of the art staffs are still in L.A. also. Prodigy's bunches right there at the Nickelodeon studios around around Burbank. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of representation. This is what I said today about being the insidious infiltration of Comic-Con. Star Trek was so away from the table that it helped build, but for mm-hmm. the 12 years, the Fowler years, had nothing. And it's only been since 2016 and the 50th that they began to creep back. You know, the 50th anniversary and Beyond, which hoo-ha, it's another movie. But then all the announcements as Discovery came down, you know, new Star Trek. There had been, 2015 was like, I think my panel was maybe like a fourth of the Star Trek you could find.
Oh, really?
Huge San Diego. So it's been a huge comeback. So good on, you know, CBS and good on Paramount. This year, the thing was not only the big studio stuff and the Wrath of Pecan ice cream truck and the 10 forward pop-up, the thing that had kicked off this the premiere for Picard for promotional. They kept those set pieces and brought it down to San Diego. And that was a lot of, for people that bought tickets to at the bar and people who went to the public outside space, that was all well and good. But to see, if you did a search on the programming bar for Star Trek, you got like 60 answers because there were so many people with a Star Trek credit, costumers mm-hmm. and visual effects and writers and storyboard artists and composers and go down the line. There were all these panels that had people, five or six different people, not from a show, but from a craft or a topic like mm-hmm. Afrofuturism or women as hyphenates. In Jerry Taylor's mm-hmm. time, they would just say she's a triple threat. But now they say mm-hmm. they're multi-hyphenates, like writer, producer, director, whatever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there would be, you get into it and you figure out what's the Star Trek connection. And this is my point. Those kind of panels, there were 20 or 30 of those. And they had a Star Trek rep on them. It was no big deal. But what that did was think of all the years Star Trek was too early. The Berman era was too early for the Hall H moment and Comic-Con. Mm-hmm. And now that it is, it went 12 years without being there as it was building. And now they're scrambling to get in and have the, you know, go from a baby high chair at the big boys table to an adult chair at the big boys table. And this is what's happening. The Hall H splash and headlines are great. But the insidious thing is how these panels. So what does that do? Fans see somebody from Star Trek on a panel. And if they're a Star Trek fan, they go, oh, yay, that's who that person, that's who that face is for that name. Yeah. And if they're not a Star Trek fan, they go, oh, well, I kind of like the stuff they showed. Oh, that's Star Trek now? I mean, and then if mm-hmm. you're a colleague, if you're a peer, you're like, oh, Star Trek's doing hot stuff. You know, if you're sitting on the other end of the panel. I mean, seriously. And if you're media, you're suddenly seeing Star Trek credits all through. I mean, it's just across the board, to me, the real revolution, what's happening right now is that when you're talking about, you know, because Comic-Con is a fan con. I was just saying this today. It's a fan con for fans to go to. It's a trade show for all these industries and licensees and studios. But it's also like a big, massive networking group and lots of peers get together and hang out, right? And go to each other's parties and shows. And so on three different levels, that's why Comic-Con San Diego is so huge. And that's why this is just as important to me, now that I realize it, as the big Hall H moment. And of course, we love the big Hall H, and that's what we're going to talk about. But it was the big change to me was seeing so, and it wasn't all just the Picard local people. There were lots of Strange New Worlds and Discovery folks from all those different, you know, guilds and things there. So mm-hmm. sorry to go on about that, but that was just kind of that was my huge takeaway from the weekend. I was like, oh my God, this is where the real long term, this is where the kids, it's not just about having action figures to buy in Target and Walmart and have the kids watch Prodigy and grow up with Star Trek. It's like, here's where the nuts and bolts of rebuilding the fan base and rebuilding the franchise respected. So anyway, that's a thing that never occurred to me until this year. And I've been trying to scream that from the rooftops.
It's really interesting because it did for a while feel like Star Trek was fading into the background after Enterprise ended and we had that
gone out
before
Chris,
the
gone,
movie
totally.
Or gone, right? Yeah. And even when we were having the Kelvin films before Discovery came around, it did feel like Star Trek was that thing that we loved from the past that was starting to fade away or, as you said, was gone. But now it's like a vibrant player in the industry.
Yeah. The Kelvin movies were like some reunion tour that your band says they're going to, your favorite band from high school or college says, we're thinking about getting back together. We might. And even when they do it. And it's like watching for another Monty Python documentary. It's kind of like, okay, but, you know, and that's all. It's what I've always preached. The movies are great, no matter what universe they're in, but it's not small screen Star Trek pumping out serialized or standalone. Mm-hmm. It's not pumping out the, it's not Star Trek's first best destiny. And that's another ramification of getting by, you know, Star Trek cannot live on movies alone. And that's another example of why, what you just said.
So let me ask you this. We're going to go into that other franchise for a moment. Of course, there was the headline. I didn't see the clip and exactly what William Shatner said, although knowing social media and the way people react these days, I figured that most likely someone took a clip of what he said and tried to turn it into a huge thing where he's apparently said F Star Wars, but not Mark Hamill. Now, knowing Shatner, I just thought, I'm sure he's joking because it's Shatner and this sounds like one of the ways that he would joke. But the main reason I bring that up is that I feel like Star Wars and Star Trek are really helping each other a lot right now because of the duel between Disney Plus and Paramount Plus. And there are these two franchises that each studio can latch onto and keep generating content. And we're constantly seeing, oh, there's a new Star Wars series in development. There's a new Star Trek series in development. So they really seem to be pushing each other forward.
Look, Chris, if anybody is winning here, it's Star Wars because they had no, and I'm saying that thinking that Star Trek is fun. It's not a race. It's not a contest. And it's always, you know, each one stands on its own, whatever. I've just always cared for Star Trek for what it is and still cannot believe that there was enough there in Star Wars to last as long as it has, but it has, and that's cool, but it's becoming less that way. I'm getting more and more reason for it because they finally got off this movie high horse and started cranking out. Well, you don't have to say small screen anymore when you've got a 60-inch plasma, but small screen episodic, you know, getting off the movie train. Yeah. I used to say it was all math because Star Trek had 780 hour, whatever, of episodes. Yeah, right. And you could count Star Wars on one hand. You had 6 2-hour movies until the animated series, you know, but they were so small fry.
Hey, don't forget the Ewok specials now, Larry. Let's don't diss the Ewoks.
we don't talk about Ewoks. No. I talk about Ewoks. Cause I love having the distance in Star Wars. So I'm like, fine, whatever. But I think Star Wars, does this sound crazy? Star Wars is becoming more not legitimate, like it did, it was illegitimate, but legitimate in having something to say and not depend on, I mean, they love to talk about the EU, the extended universe, right? Not the European Union, but the extended universe. You know, the books and the comics and the games and the trading cards and whatever. But they leaned on that for the bulk of their canon and their universe for years, where Star Trek was on film and coordinated with a glitch here and there, but still core. And it's funny to see Star Wars lean into, now they're still dinky series. They're still just 4 and 8 and 10 episode series, and they're never going to catch up to Star Trek. And it's not about keeping score, but I'm just saying, if you want to be heart invested in a huge unit, that's why Star Trek Online was screaming to be a multiplayer game for years, because Star Trek has the most fleshed out universe of anything, I want to say. But Star Wars, if nothing else, you said that competition between the two. I think when I say Star Wars is winning, I don't mean it's beating Star Trek. I mean, they're of who's benefiting from being pushed. It's Star Wars, because they finally woke up, and was it Kathleen Kennedy running the franchise? They were like, why don't we do small screen? We can push our Disney Plus, but we can start fleshing out our universe and filling these gaps.
Yeah.
You know, more that we can't do when we're waiting on a good or bad movie. We're waiting every 2 years, which is where Paramount was in the 80s.
Yeah. But I feel like Disney is pushing Paramount with Star Trek now, too. One thing I thought was really interesting is that if you watch Star Wars on Disney Plus, they have this little pre-roll thing where they show the light coming across the droids and everything, and it just says Star Wars. It's like the Star Wars universe.
It's like a little branding, branding intro thing. Yeah.
And that went on for a while, and then Paramount started doing it for Star Trek now. And the first time I saw it, I was like, you guys saw Disney doing that for Star Wars and decided to do your own, right?
Well, and it didn't hurt that rather than have just like one show and people are arguing about it every week, you've now got five. You have animation and live action. You've got a full year's worth of content. Yeah.
But my point about all of this is it's a competition between the studios, not a competition between the franchises per se. And I love them both, so I'm very happy about it. But I think that it's wonderful that there are aspects of streaming that I think are detrimental to storytelling and to being creative. But
when you say streaming, do you mean serialized?
No, I don't. I mean the platform itself.
Oh,
this idea of we're going to do 10 episode seasons. I think 10 episode seasons are detrimental to character building. I think that you can build characters in 10 episodes per season and make it interesting. It helps if there's some basis for it. I think Umbrella Academy has done a good job of making you interested in characters and kind of knowing characters with 10 episodes in a season. And it's based on a graphic novel series by Dark Horse. But if you look at what Discovery has done, for example, they've utterly failed to develop characters with these short seasons because of the serialization focus. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what Strange New Worlds has done, they've done a great job of making you care about characters with 10 episode season because they've taken the approach of characters first, plot second, instead of the other way around. So that's what I mean when I say that the streaming can be detrimental to the creative, but in ways that I think that it has benefited is the push that we're talking about, encouraging more creative and not resting on your laurels with one series and allowing it to become plotting. And the other thing that I think is great about it is the ability to tell a story that is the length that it needs to be. So you can have a 35-minute episode or a 1-hour, 10-minute episode, and you don't have to put in a bunch of filler, and you also don't have to gut the story just so you can get commercials in.
Yeah. And, you know, it's almost like it was funny for years and years and years until the streaming model came along. America was all about commercial 24, 26-hour episode seasons.
Yeah.
And then maybe something like PBS or one of the cable networks, paid subscription, or PBS would have not even an import, but have an American-made 10-parter or something. Well, it was PBS. They don't have as much money.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're not going to do 26. They're going to do... But for the model, whether it was... You know, the BBC has had... Like Doctor Who had had its wacky and varying, you know, format structures over the year, over the years. But we would you know, PBS would bring over BBC or British content that was 8 and 10 episode seasons, and they're used to it. And then we saw the streaming model come in with the 10 episode seasons because they're doing, you know, cinematic TV, and they're spending billions, a few million per episode, where instead of having a 26-hour season, you're spending $1.5 million like TNG days, they're spending, $4, $5, $6 million an episode for 10. So there's a lot of quality. There's a lot of bang for the buck there, but they're just starting on at a higher plane.
Yeah.
I mean, and there's a lot of variables in the mix here, and it's been a slow time coming, but it's still not just the 10. As you said, you could do the 10. Strange New Worlds has been masterful at having a top to bottom, you know, crew. I mean, I could say the same thing about Lower Decks, but that's animation. But it's it still is all about, what's the attitude? Who's running the show? What do they feel like their charge is?
Yeah.
You know, and we should get into this, but people who love to lump, say, Discovery and Picard together and then single out, now they did that constantly. Now people say, oh yeah, Strange New is, and I'm sorry, I'm going to say this up front. For some reason, I cannot say Strange New Worlds. It's just one syllable too many. I call the series Strange, or I call it Strange New. So don't get upset, everybody. That's just...
How about Doctor Strange New?
Doctor Strange New. No, that's two syllables. That's not helping. It's not helping, Chris. But Strange New Worlds, somebody say, oh, well, that's because it's, it's standalone episodes. But even Discovery and Picard on this topic, even. So Discovery is just all about the representation and being weird. At least it was in the beginning.
Well, and okay, Picard, so when you say being weird, though, like, let's define the word weird, though. You mean different from other Star Trek series?
Well, no, I mean like Spore Drive. I mean weird redesigned Klingons. Technologies that don't fit the time, or they do, or whatever you want to yell about it. Mm-hmm. And then in one season, we're going to go Klingon War, Spore Drive, Mirror Universe, back to Spore Drive, throw in a little planet exploring, and then wrap up a Klingon War all in one season. And then the next year, we're going to go chase Five Lights with an anime suit put into live action. And then we're going to, so everybody can do the superhero poses as you run to take runoff and you try to hit 85 miles an hour and hit the clock tower or something, whatever. So and then Picard, though, is all about this guy late in life. It's all character based.
Mm-hmm.
And you barely had five or six characters around him. And then a few more after that. It's not a crew. You don't have 1,000 people in depth on a starship crew, or even a space station. It's not the same dynamic. Discovery is different from Picard that way. They're totally different. Mm-hmm. And people who lump them both together, I just want to say, aside from the writing staffs and the creative staffs being 95% different. They're different. So I hear you talking about Strange New, and that's all good. And then the animateds are a totally different flavor both directions.
So I think what we're saying here is that...
What are we saying, Chris?
Okay. Well, if you look at social media, what I typically see is a division between New Trek and Old Trek or Classic Trek. And
is it 1986, Chris? Are we talking about Classic Trek and NU Trek? Because that was the term involved in 1986. People were screaming about these usurpers trying to make you forget about Kirk and Spock and McCoy. How dare they make us try to forget about real Star Trek?
Well, using these terms new and classic, now I just had Clear Trek pop into my head. We've got New Coke, Classic Coke. We've got Clear Pepsi. The 80s are back, but...
Well, that's where New Trek came from, was New Coke. That whole thing was right at the same time. Now, the Clear Pepsi, though... That's a whole different... There's our new sidelong. We're 30 years in the future.
Yeah.
30,
yeah.
80.
Oh, and do you remember the clear beer as well? Was it Budweiser? Mm-hmm. Someone made a clear beer at the same time. But anyway, there's this...
And then we had near clear beer. It was just sad. Okay.
Yeah. And then Zima came along. But so we have this division that there's this wall put up. And I see a lot of people who, anytime you mention any of the modern series, I'm doing air quotes here on the camera, they say anything after Berman sucks, or anything in the Kurtzman era sucks. It's not Star Trek. But I think that the way you're describing it, and the way I think about it, is that right now we have Strange New Worlds, Picard, Lower Decks, Prodigy, Discovery. These are all active series, and they all have their own character. So whereas before, we had just the original series, and then we had just the Next Generation, and then we had that overlapping time of TNG and Deep Space Nine, and then DS9 and Voyager. But really, all three of those series felt really close to each other. It's just the situations they were in the galaxy were a little bit different, but the tone of the show was not really that different. And then Enterprise was quite similar to those as well.
Sadly,
but what we have now really is... We have this rich franchise that is showing how this one universe can manifest itself in very different ways and satisfy groups of fans, like within the overall fandom. And, it really is not necessary to love all of these series. I like them all because I like anything that's related to Star Trek, but the diversity of what's possible in the Star Trek universe is being seen now in a way that we never saw before.
It's almost as if, I don't know, it's almost as if we had a buffet of Star Trek flavors. And you might enjoy good old American steak and hamburgers more than you do anything on the Asian buffet table or the seafood buffet table, you know, or the Mexican buffet table. But it's there, and somebody else in your group might like that too. And somebody might go fill up a plate from everything.
Yeah, but remember, Larry, on this buffet, it's not all you can eat. You can only get 10 servings, and then you have to leave.
Yes, and you have to pay for it by the month. that's the metaphor that I started using ages ago. Yeah. But you did. You said, when you said Kurtzman sucks, Chris, I know you're just a wee pup.
No, I didn't say Kurtzman sucks. I said that people online.
That's what I meant to
just
say.
Just to be clear. Yes.
Yes, just to be clear. But I'm saying people who use that phrase, Kurtzman sucks, I just want to think, I love trotting out the original series, like the fan fiction, the fanzine fandom, who were really dead set against Next Gen because they were so embedded with Spock and Spock and Kirk and Spock and McCoy and Spock and the original series era that they didn't see. I mean, none of us really saw what was about to happen. The whole point, it wasn't just, oh, here's an old show and the new show is not going to compete with it because we're going to put it in the future. Boy, that's kind of genius. And a lot of people didn't even get that. But what it took a while to realize, we say this all the time, Star Trek invented all the buzzwords without having the buzzwords. We had a multi-cinema, we had a multi-whatever universe when we had two series on at a time, a third, and a third, and then we had movies. We had the bare beginnings of now what everybody craves, only we just did it because everybody wanted damn more Star Trek, but the canvas was so huge, we were still filling in little tiny bits of it, and we're still filling in little tiny bits of that canvas. Pick a century. Pick a universe, pick a timeline. We've still done just baby steps, in the prime timeline over the 300 years. Okay, now with the future century, has barely been sketched in still.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like I've built a restaurant of 30 rooms and I've opened a buffet, but I'm only using the first two rooms of the 30 room mansion for my buffet extravaganza, my smorgasbord, if you would. So.
And while you're doing that, Kurtzman is roaming the halls, opening the doors to the other rooms, like, I wonder what I could put in here, right?
I'll tell him. We've had people for 30 years trying to say what it should be in there, and people will still be happy to give ideas. So anyway, that's what my final point there was, the people who say Kurtzman sucks, I just wanted to say, can I time travel you back to about 2002, 2003, 2004, and the old meme of where they had the two hobos with signs and they would, the early days of memeing, and they would put Brannon and Rick's faces on the two of them. And one of them is holding a sign that says, "We'll wreck a franchise for food." people, it's so amazing because that's the passage of time in rose covered glasses. And we will eventually get there too. And we will critique things for what they are. And there may be a whole new generation who rises up and says, not, oh gosh, that show, I lost two episodes of Deep Space Nine when they bumped it to 2 a.m. because of the hockey game, and now I'm totally lost, so I just gave up trying to watch it. That's so insane to say that now in our time of binge-watching everything. So, 20 or 30 years from now, somebody may rise up and say something about, say, Discovery. And it's a whole nother level to it that we had no way of identifying right now.
Well, because the format right now will be so antiquated to that group of fans, because they will be accustomed to seasons that have 47 3-minute episodes on whatever platform comes after TikTok.
And seeing it on, Nine Ray Pink J or whatever.
Pink Ray. Pink, 9K Pink Ray.
Yes, 9K Pink Ray.
Star Trek on 9K. Pink Ray. Oh, wow. All right. Okay. So why don't we transition? I want to talk a little bit about each series because we haven't talked about these in quite a long time. And in some of them, we haven't talked about them at all together. Strange New Worlds, or as you call it, Strange New, is one of those that we haven't really talked about. So what did you think about that first season?
Okay, so not to jump subject here, when Lower Decks wrapped up its first season, I remember thinking, wow, I think this is the most together first season since the original series.
Mm-hmm.
Even with that wobbly early teaser that, out of context, I was really thrown by.
Which we talked about on here, I think.
Which we talked about, right. It took me two viewings to realize that that Mariner was drunk.
Right.
Was not her, right. And after watching Strange New Worlds, I'm wondering if somewhere, I've seen some people just come out and proclaim it to be the best first season ever, including the original series, which is still kind of mind-boggling since
anytime
the original series.
That, I think of recency bias. Anytime I hear someone who reacts so quickly to something new.
But did you Regency bias?
Recency bias.
Oh, recency, because I was thinking, well, now, you know, cut Victoria some slack. She, okay. Talking about BBC dramas. yes, thank you for that term. Recency bias is the thing when you see clickbait titles like best 30 best sitcoms ever, and they're all since 1990.
Yeah.
On down the line. 30 best pro teams, 30 best TV NFL moments ever. And I'm sorry, it was only in the color era and when there was a camera on the field. Who knows what the best pro moment was in the 20s? The old
often
ones.
These days, those articles are like from the past 3 years.
Right? Yeah, at least there's some caveats.
Like, it'll be like, since I started watching this franchise.
Right? Yeah.
Which was last Thursday.
But having said that, it's hard to, it's like picking what, like all-time teams or like best quarterbacks of different eras. How do you compare apples to oranges to bananas to fruitcakes, you know, across eras? So, but it was an amazing first season. And you could tell the intentionality. You listen to, I want to get into this because Akiva Goldsman has been the legacy, like underneath Alex Kurtzman, whether this was the plan or he's just got a good manager. He's been involved with the setup of Discovery and Picard and Stranger. He's got his fingers and residual pie on all these series. So I don't know where the balance falls, but Henry Alonzo Myers is the showrunner and a huge fan. Huge fan. Will compete with you on titles and episodes, you know, whatever. That's the thing. It's becoming the norm on these. And when you see Mike McMahon, it's animated, you know, whatever. But Terry Metalis on the second season or second and third seasons of Picard and on down the line. But Henry Alonzo Myers and his staff are all dyed-in-the-wool fans as well as being professionals. And you can tell when he says something, not about like, say, like the canon eras we wanted to look at the Gorn. Well, okay, well, maybe that evolved eventually. But one of the main things he said is we wanted to prove that we could do different, we could show the old Star Trek and the old TOS, bar of we're going to do different tones. We're going to do comedy. Yeah. We're going to do drama. We're going to do horror. We're going to do hijinks. We're going to do, I don't know, courtroom dramas. We're going to do romantic comedies. We're going to do, you know, whatever. We're going to do all of that different tones to show you how we stretch the envelope. And this is how, you know, Star Trek is Shakespearean almost that way. So you can tell that that was a driving force out of the gate because they are, when they're standalones, especially, you can do that. And he has made the point and others that when you are Discovery and Picard, and one of the things that people pick up on episodes like Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go My, you know, the time loop one, which gave you the chance
from Discovery.
From Discovery, do a little, the Harry Mudd one with the time loops. And you could have a little levity. You could be droll, grim, black comedy levity. Or you can do, say, Nepenthe on Picard or have the Stardust City, you know, goofball costumes bit. Other than that, though, because they were so serialized and you had the big bad and just the nature of the beast and maybe not the most experienced yet in doing this, they tended to be relentlessly dramatic and sometimes even relentlessly grim. And people recoiled at that they were dark and not just literally dark, Like, how does anybody see where to go on the Discovery? I don't know. And the La Serena is a big freighter anyway. It's not a cruise ship. So, you know, one thing that you get with that freedom to have a different tone, because your storytelling is a reset each time, not the character arcs, but the story arcs, is you can have that. And you can tell the DNA sat down from the beginning. It wasn't a happy accident stumbled into. It was the thing out of the gate. And that was one of the bonuses they could play with. And if people are responding more positive to Strange New Worlds, and especially it's like the longer a fan they are, the more they respond to that, because they go back to the variety on the Berman era, much less the original series. So again, that goes back to the ripples of the butterfly effects of saying we're going to do standalone versus the serialized story. You know what? I still think it's possible. What if you had a 10-episode season serialized story that was, you know, Dorothy going to get home, and she has to go see the witch and the wizard, and there's light moments, and there's, I mean, I just think as they get more adept, I still think no one quite grasps the difficulty of doing Star Trek in this format. Doing Game of Thrones, which is kind of relentlessly grim, and Walking Dead, kind of relentlessly, you know, dystopian. Yeah. Has anybody ever done a fun hunky-dory series serialized? Well, for one thing, Star Trek was serialized or standalone. It was an anomaly anyway. So now you're going to do it through that, you know, anyway. When you have to have the stakes be ever higher because it's serialized and you've got to have a chapter end. You know, when you write a 1 hour in the old days and you had to get out for a commercial, your act breaks had to be dump, 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 you know, in the old days. And you very rarely ended on a laugh. It was usually some dramatic thing. Well, now instead of doing it three times in an hour, you've got to do it all these times over 10 episodes. Anyway, it's, you know, this is gradually dawning on everybody what the dynamics of all these basic choices are. So people think they love Strange New Worlds for some reason, and not even realize why yet. And that's one of the reasons why.
I think for me, and I loved the first season very much. I think they did a fantastic job. There are only a few moments here and there that I wasn't crazy about, a few choices that I wasn't crazy
about.
Maybe
a misfire here and there.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, it's nothing major. And being a creative myself, it's easy for me to put myself in the shoes of the people creating the show and understand why they made the decision. So it's fine. I think the big thing for me is that it really felt like Star Trek. And if you look at Discovery in particular, and you're talking about the growing pains of trying to figure out how to take a common storytelling format on television, this serialized drive where everything is overly dramatic and the stakes are super high at the end and all.
And overlay on a writing staff in chaos and change.
Well, yeah, and that's something we've talked about before, which doesn't help. But I think that you've seen, like on Discovery, I think you've seen bit by bit them learn how to actually apply that to Star Trek instead of just writing generic science fiction and setting it in the Star Trek universe.
Chris? Psst. Chris, yes. I don't know if you've noticed it, but Discovery is actually four different series. But don't tell anybody that.
That's a really good point, actually.
Brian actually got his, you know, his different setting every series idea. It's like the revenge of Brian Fuller. He wanted an anthology season by season series like American, you know, Horror Story, and he secretly got it. But don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody.
But it's actually a good point, because the show does feel like a different series. It almost feels like a different series every four seasons. But I just feel like, you know, people remember, I know some people don't want to hear any constructive criticism of the series, but the first season of Discovery, it was very easy to predict what was going to happen. The plot was very transparent because it was just generic storytelling set in the Star Trek universe. Second season got a little bit better. And then over time, it got a little bit better. And I think the fourth season was immensely better in that respect. And going back to Strange New Worlds, which we're actually talking about right now, I think that one reason why it connected with me so well and with a lot of fans is that the threads that tie it to Star Trek as a franchise and back to the original series are much stronger. And the episodic nature, it did help. And they have serialization in the way that Deep Space Nine and Voyager and Enterprise had serialization, particularly maybe more in the vein of Voyager Enterprise, not quite as heavy as DS9 became in its later seasons. And that's something that I just feel like that connects with people a lot more. And that's also why Lower Decks, which we'll talk about, connects with people as well, because it's that type of storytelling.
Well, I think one thing we talked about, like, you know, arcs and running arcs, I think people have figured out the difference also between character arcs and story arcs. And we had character arcs with Odo being solid or not, or Worf being discommendated or not, Troy wearing the uniform or not. No.
Troy being able to read someone's mind or not.
Or not. Oh, that's all Ferengi. That's all Ferengi.
Depends on what the story needed.
But. Yeah. And I think people get it that the you know, serialized storytelling is a story arc over 10 seasons. And I hate that. Mm-hmm. I hate the phrase the big bad now, because that's kind of that's the big bad bugaboo. If your big bad falls a little flat, and I'm sorry, I think the kid that screamed in the wrong place at the wrong time, season 3 Discovery, kind of fell flat. And I've even said, had that been a one or maybe a two-parter plot, people would say, wow, what an ingenious thing. But when you hung the whole season on it, I think
it's the culmination
of... Really?
Well, it was the idea that the Federation and basically all galactic interaction between civilizations was destroyed because one kid screamed. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is why it fell flat.
At the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right. For that to be the downfall of the entire Federation. But anyway, so Strange New Worlds, I want to ask you one other question before we move on. It feels like with Strange New Worlds that there's this assumption that everyone is coming into the series having watched Discovery Season 2, and maybe also that they're aware of Pike from the original series and what happened to him. And if you didn't watch Discovery Season 2 and you didn't see the cage or the menagerie, which is very, very possible with today's fans, placing the events of Strange New Worlds on the timeline, I think, is not obvious. The fact that the cage already happened and
five
Pike
years
knows,
earlier.
Yeah. Yes. So the fact that they do show you flashbacks, so you at least know that Pike saw this vision of himself in the future being injured.
All the flashbacks from the pivotal Discovery episode.
Right.
From Boreth with the time crystals. And
so that's in the future. So that part is kind of made clear, but the other big thing about Pike, how he was introduced with the cage, the fact that that has already happened some years before is not actually established in Strange New Worlds. And so if you go into this without the knowledge of all of that, and if you didn't watch Discovery Season 2, and so you don't even know about Boreth and the Time Crystal and all other than what's explained briefly in Strange New Worlds, I think it may be confusing, or it may change kind of the way you feel about the show and what you're seeing. But do you think that's an issue for the storytelling itself, or should they have done something to kind of establish? Because I kind of thought that the beginning of the series might give us flashbacks to what happened to Pike in the past before they just jumped right into the story.
Well, you know, Chris, if memory serves, you like that? The Discovery episode was on Talos IV, where Pike gets to see his future. I had not stopped to think about this, because it makes me what that makes me do is consider how many people are watching Strange New without having to come to Yes, like what you said, had not been Discovery
which,
people.
Which I think
because I hear people say, I don't really pursue it. And like today, it's Comic-Con, or yesterday, today, last weekend, I did my "What did you come to Star Trek with?" And we had two in a room of 80 or 100 people. We had two or three that said Strange New was their first Star Trek. Mm-hmm. So just to say.
But I think there are a lot of fans, and I haven't polled, and even if I did, it wouldn't be scientific. I think that there are a lot of fans who, they like TOS, TNG all the way through. Maybe they don't like Enterprise. Maybe they never watched DS9, because there are mm-hmm. a lot of those fans who watched mm-hmm. TOS, TNG, Voyager, and then they didn't watch DS9. They watched a little bit at the beginning, didn't like it, so they didn't keep watching.
There are a lot of fans that dropped off after TNG and didn't watch Voyager or DS9.
Right. And there are a lot of fans who were turned off by Discovery, and so they didn't watch the second season. Maybe they watched part of the first one, and then they dropped off. Mm-hmm. But because they know Pike, and they love Spock, and Number One is here, and now in the second...
And I think a huge amount of positivity is in the zeitgeist that was not there for Discovery. And even Picard after about half a season.
Yeah.
I think there's so much of that out there. I think a lot of people have come back to give it a try.
Right. Yeah. And that's what I think. And so I think that there are a lot of people watching this series who did not watch Discovery Season 2.
Mm-hmm.
And
I hear you.
There's this assumption that everybody just knows everything that's going on, and they know what happened in Discovery, but I think that's not necessarily true. And one reason that I bring this up is that Matthew and I, we did Saddle Up together. We went all the way through week by week, every episode, and I didn't realize until the very end, and I didn't even think about it when I edited the show, but then listeners brought it up, that Matthew wasn't clear on where this story is taking place in relation to the cage. Because sometimes when we talk about the story, like we say the cage, but we're talking about the menagerie because we're talking about mm-hmm. the clips from it and all. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of thought about it that way. And then after all of it, realized that, actually, Matthew was thinking that the cage is coming up. Now, a lot of fans think, that's ridiculous. How could you think that? You're a Star Trek fan. But if you really stop and think about it, this show, it doesn't make any of that clear to the viewer. So you only really know that if you're coming into it from Discovery, and then you know. I mean, you know that the accident hasn't happened yet, but in the cage, the accident hadn't happened yet either. Right.
Right. Well, this is a whole point you're opening up here. Yeah. Number one, I remember on the eve of, after waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for the show and knowing that it was going to follow Discovery, right? His appearance on Discovery, I should say. And Discovery's vaulted into the future and they all lied and said they didn't know and it blew up. And okay, that's the last we saw of Number One in Spock.
Yeah, they all lied and then they named a shuttlecraft the Stamets.
Yes,
but
well, he was a martyred hero that was working on this project that just never turned out.
Yeah. Actually, that's true. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. No, that they're naming that for Dr. Paul Stamets from the early 21st century.
Right. Right. The guy you can look up on Amazon.
Right. Right. Right.
He has a book.
The shuttle pod Pike on the D was named for John Pike, president of Paramount Pictures. Not Captain Pike. Or at least that's what he thought at the time. This is an interesting point. Okay, so on the eve of Strange New Worlds, I was not sure where they were putting it. And I went and I looked and so here's Memory Alpha and it says 2259. I'm like, okay. So I'm watching the first episode. Nothing in the first episode except for this vague idea finally that he's been in a funk ever since his time on Discovery and he saw his future. But you're not sure. There's some kind of a timey thing, but you just have a vague notion that it's not been too long, but it's been longer than a week, but it hasn't mm-hmm. been a year. So you kind of have that idea. And then if you want to go back and refresh, okay, have they reframed where Discovery left, or is that still 2258-ish or early 59-ish or whatever? But, you know, it's vague to that. But what I noticed as the season went along, and especially with the finale, And especially as, and this is something we haven't talked about at all, the division between the new characters and the legacy characters and all the choices behind the legacy characters. And the first few episodes, kind of the same thing with the Gorn, but Spock, Chapel, T'Pring, and to a lesser extent, M'Benga. The alarm bells that went off with people, and I had them too, until I sat down and did basic research. They have incredibly threaded the needle on the canon timeline to where they are totally on safe ground. And even the way that people thought that Jess Bush and Chapel was not matching Majel and Chapel from TOS, I totally beg to differ. I think Majel is not only smiling right now, but she's intensely jealous, because I think she would have loved to have done what Jess Bush is getting to do with her Chapel.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Just in a blank check way, not even talking about the triangle with T'Pring and Spock and all that yet, which I think all can fit because we know what happens to T'Pring. It's just fascinating to think we're layering in texture that we all just took for granted because we only had 3 or 4 points, not 30 or 40 points. And now the texture is going to be just fine. But these things like, oh, she's nothing like Majel's Chapel. It's like, no, because we only saw Majel's Chapel through a keyhole.
Right. Yeah.
And the time she got to do something else, like when she faked her way with the microtape and said it was, you know, and McCoy says, it's a survey of Signy and respiratory diseases. What are you doing? She says, I'm applying a little psychology. That was a taste of what, you know, could have been. And everything about T'Pring and Chapel and Spock, the one moment that Spock talks about T'Pring, not with Pike in number one and even Chapel now, and Binga probably, apparently, but to Kirk and McCoy, and yes, Uhura, if you notice, Uhura has never met T'Pring in Strange New World. Anyway, there's a lot of needle threading going on here that is going to be just fine and work and no verbal. But the one reaction Chapel has to T'Pring on screen is a, and I just say her, oh my God, look, her, you know, whipsawed look at Spock is not, what do you mean? Who is this girl? What do you mean who she is? Her look is about, what do you mean her wife? Like, I thought you two had parted ways years ago, or else why would I be throwing this, you know, why would Majel Chapel be throwing herself at Spock or at least trying to be coy about it? Because Jess Bush's Chapel looks at Spock and says, no, Mr. Spock, you're an honorable man. You would never lead somebody on, which I thought was amazing. It's like, oh my God, she's setting up the Chapel for later on. And the whole reason she whips up, you know, she's in shock looking at him. But that's the only thing you get because Chapel is number 8 on the call list. And the next thing you know, in a muck time, they're beaming down the planet and you're on with the main story. But everything they have done, to me, is totally fine. And the Gorn are about life cycle of the Gorn, and that's going to be fine too. There's a couple of things that are a little wonky to me with Strange New. Like, in real life, Pike had his accident. Tell me, true or false, Chris, in the prime timeline that we know, what happened first? Pike had his accident, or Kirk took command of the Enterprise?
Oh, Kirk took command of the Enterprise.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, a lot of timey-wimey things in the finale happened because it was future Pike leading. It's a tapestry / Christmas Carol / you know, second season of Picard adventure here, where it's all going to reset and all go magically away when you come back. But there were a couple of times, judging by Pike's reaction, like when he sees La'an in command and not ops or whatever. You know, it's like, and you can tell his reaction by what he thinks the reality is.
Yeah.
Anyway, that thing about that and the Farragut were a couple of points. But basically, people are losing track, to your original point. This is 2059. The finale, the first season is 7 years later, 6 and 7 years later, where No Man is 6 and then the rest is 7. So there's 6, 7 years for all of these legacy characters to have a lot more happen to them. And it obviously does.
Yeah.
And it's 6 and 7 years. And then that kind of got a little timey-wimey with the finale, because you were talking about fake timeline 7 years hence. You know, I mean, you were bridging years as well as realities.
But that was an alternate timeline, so it doesn't all have to match up completely. But it matches
I did
up.
A Tuesday thing about people are forgetting that 7 years goes by before we talk about Spock and Chapel and T'Pring and Mbenga even. And Pike.
Yeah, that's definitely happening. Okay. All right. Well, let's move on because I want to talk about
I know, but we're not going to talk much about here.
Those other ones, who needs those? You know, they're old news. They're old news. So Picard, we haven't talked about season two of Picard, and I am curious what you thought about the story, about bringing Q back, about the portrayal of Q in that story, which was, you know, quite different than the Q that we've gotten in the past. Mm-hmm. You've got a Q that's coming to terms with his own mortality, which is something we've never thought about before, that Q could be mortal.
Now, what about Quinn and wanting to commit suicide?
But see, it's different. Like with Quinn, he needed to commit suicide because otherwise he couldn't die.
I know, but the whole concept of a Q dying is what I'm saying.
Oh, the concept of a Q dying is one thing, but the concept of John Delancey's Q dying and the way that he is, they don't really explain why he's dying.
He had Q cancer. Didn't you catch that?
I guess so, which is an interesting thing, but
I just threw that out. No, that's not. There is no Q cancer canon.
The portrayal of Q in season two, I thought was very interesting. I think John Delancey did a great job with it. And I thought it was very touching that he wants to help Jean-Luc as like a final gesture. And I also think that when you get to the end of that story, it informs how you read all those past interactions between Q and Picard, which I think if you're going to tell a story like this, it shouldn't be just to bring back characters because people love the characters. It should be that the story somehow provides texture and background.
Be careful. You're going to piss off half a fandom that wants everything to keep going exactly the way it always did. Don't change.
Yes, yes. There is a group within fandom like that. But, you know, I've never been a fan of sequels. It doesn't matter what the franchise is. I don't like sequels. But occasionally people make a sequel that's much better than what came before. Toy Story 2 is an example. A more recent example is Top Gun Maverick, which was a fantastic movie, which is far better than the original movie, even though the original is considered a classic. And in our memories, we think of it as being this great movie.
Until you go back and look at it without your 80s eyeglasses on. And then
Right, yeah. And I think here, what they did with season 2 of Picard is another example of they're not remaking anything, but they're revisiting this relationship between two characters in a way that strengthens what came before it. And so I found it interesting how many people I saw who hated season 2 of Picard and thought it was terrible. I've seen people say it's the worst Star Trek made in decades. And for me, I thought it
they
was
didn't
some
see
of the best
Discovery
Star Trek.
Season. Well, I didn't say that. Okay.
Okay, Larry. But I do think it is, like you say, characters like Picard and Q, people love their interactions from the Next Generation, and maybe they want more of that, and they don't want this growth in the relationship between the characters that we got here, perhaps. And, of course, they don't want to say farewell to a favorite character.
Yeah. Well, I had two things real quick. I had a synapse snap just then. I know back in the day, but you brought it up again. Again, the way he's treated through the season. Well, there's a lot of mystery. Well, here's a question. What did you enjoy more, season one or season two of Picard?
I think I enjoyed season two more because of the way they handled some important issues with the characters, things that we can relate to as individuals as well. Yeah. Like season one, I liked, but there are things that also didn't quite make sense in terms of Picard and his ongoing anguish about Data's death and so forth. It was like okay, I get where you got the idea and it makes sense, but how many years have gone by and he still feels this way? And then the whole stuff with the Borg cube felt like it was thrown in to have a Borg connection. And then we had the weird Romulan siblings thing.
I was going to say, I thought there was a lot of like wasted time in real estate in this.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the 10 episodes, I thought, wow, you could have done a lot more with that instead of having the two incest twins hanging around talking angsty in the dark with each other
about plots
and plans and snarling like villains. You could have done more with that time. And I didn't think that – I didn't see near that kind of thing. In, although there were some simple – when they, those scenes when they're out walking in the forest, they're having all their important meetings in the woods or in the basement of a warehouse – mm-hmm. You know, the evidence locker, whatever it's supposed to be, there are times, or, you know, or the times when I thought they were going to make this big important statement about immigration and ICE policy in the United States, and then it all just kind of went away. Like it sort of went up as a, some of those things. But I just overall felt it was a much, I think they've got a long way to go to get their arms around that storytelling. And I can't wait to see what Terry does season three, because Turbatell is. Yeah. Started off and then backed off because the season got so complex and he wanted to work on season three.
Right.
So his name is there, but it was really Akiva running the team on season two. But so, I thought it was a stronger season than season one.
Yeah, it was definitely a stronger season in terms of storytelling. And I think things like not getting too deep into making a statement about ICE or talking about the sanctuary districts or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a good creative choice because they shined a light on the issues in the way Star Trek has done in the past, but they didn't lose focus on the real story that they were telling, which was the story about Jean-Luc and Rene Picard and Q. And I think they kept their focus in a way that sometimes shows these days lose track of the story that they're actually trying to tell. And so I enjoyed it for that reason. Now, this reason that I gave that I think if you're going to bring characters back and you're going to tell a story, it needs to actually benefit what came before and not just be fan service. Season three, they're getting the whole band back together almost so they can show off their gray. And you've seen these posters.
Or white, Chris. Or white.
Well, it is white. You know, you've seen these posters, especially looking at Worf. And I just saw they said, oh, season three has like a Khan level villain. Hopefully it's not going to be Khan played by yet another actor, but they have a Khan level villain. So I do hope that season three is going to be in the vein of season two, where we are telling meaningful stories about the characters and we're providing closure because... Mm-hmm. Likely this is going to finally be the last time we see these characters.
Right.
At least most of them, I think. So are you anticipating they're going to do that? Or do you have any concern that it's going to be just sort of TNG fan service? Let's get everybody back together one more time.
No, well, I was just, this is what came out of, for the quote unquote Picard panel. It was only Patrick and Gates and then Alex Kurtzman. I knew Terry from when he was Brannon's assistant, long suffering, but starting to, you know, he sold two or three stories on his own. So he was doing the modern assistant thing of I'm a writer in waiting. I'm going to use experience to learn and make some networking here. But, I DM'd him. I said, where are you? Like, are you coming down this weekend? Are you got time for, you know, lunch? And he said, no, I'm working. I'm back home working. Now his two seasons of Picard are over, and I know he's pitching shows, so he's working on R&D or whatever. I don't know if, you know, what was going on there, but I felt it was sad that he wasn't there to rake in some of the glory and some of the excitement of the Hall H moment. But it was a very small panel, but one thing, and I wasn't in Hall H, I should tell you. I didn't mention that in the thing. I was in the sales where the Wi-Fi was very bad, so I might as well have been 2,000 miles away, not 200 yards. But Gates was talking a lot about, and I think Alex did this too, and Patrick, but basically they all said, this is not a bunch of cameos, and it's not like Picard walks in a room and boom, everybody's standing there, okay, ready to have a reunion plot, okay. It's more like picking people up at different, some of them, some of them have kept up. Well, obviously, Riker and Troy, we know they're on Nepenthe. But they've all coming from different places. It was all juicy. And Gates is one to speak her mind and saying that they're all coming from different places. So they all seem to be happy about it.
Because I was just picturing a scene where like Picard's walking around the ship and each corridor he turns down, one of them's going to be there. And he's going to say, "Oh, Mr. Worf, what the hell are you doing here?" And then the character will say, "Well, I was on my way to," and then the sound fades out, you know. And that happens for every character.
No. Well, that's been done. That's so Nemesis in First Contact and Insurrection, Chris. Yeah. Well, that quote bit for Geordi, he says, "This is what made me," he says something about, "This is what made me a man and a father." And I'm like, aha, are we going to hear Leah was his wife's name?
Yeah, you know, Leah Brahm's coming back.
He did get with Leah or who else? Anyway, it's not Aquiel. Yeah. I mean, the reaction of, you know, every week when there's actual Star Trek news, whether it's an episode or just a bunch of headlines like con headlines, if you sat down in the morning and tried to pick what would be the thing that Star Trek Twitter or socials loses its mind over, and if it's everything that came out of Hall H on Saturday, and the one thing that melted down the inner tubes was Worf's hair being white.
Yeah.
Like, really, guys? Do we have a picture of Worf in 2501 from a future forward, not altered fake timeline, like all good things, where we see he doesn't have, you know, it's like, this isn't like young Picard having hair when he's stabbed in his flashback. And yet, you know, the Nemesis young Picard is already bald. This isn't even on that level. This is like, what are you basing this on? Well, Klingons don't get Y-headed when their Koloth was Y-headed in Blood Oath.
Yeah.
You know, anyway, lots of Klingons have been Y-headed. The reaction to Worf being, I think it's almost like it like made some of these fans like resent the fact that 30 years have gone by or whatever, you know, 20 years have gone by since Nemesis in real time, much less 30 since the run of Next Gen. I think they were just resenting realizing how much older they are now than they were when they were a kid. But yeah. There's always going to be some oddball thing. So my God, if Worf having white hair is the least of your worries, it's going to be an awesome season, people. And for all those people that said, where's Crusher? Where's Geordi? Where's Worf? Well, there you go. I mean, I still feel badly for the original Picard cast. And it's interesting, the dynamics. Like, I'd like to know when the decision was made to bring them in. It was probably very early when Terry came on board for season two. And when the decision was made to wrap up almost all those characters, was it because maybe Alison Pill said, "It's been fun, guys, but I really don't need to do a third season of the show"? Was it actor-driven with clout? Was it, second season, you could almost see, like, Elsa, Brionna's, she was barely used. And maybe did they have outside work that was pulling them away? Was it the COVID production? There's all kinds of questions that we have to answer. But the big thing of only having Raffi of the original characters for Picard come back, and I'm not even including Seven, because Seven is like a Spock or a Data by this point.
Well,
so
I feel like Raffi coming back, I mean, there are two reasons. One is because of her connection to Picard in that future. And the other is her relationship with Seven. And so if you're going to bring Seven back, it makes sense to bring Raffi back.
One of the best moments of season one was that little, and it wasn't just because of the sentimental addition of the Voyager theme song, but that one bit when you think she's leaving the series, you know, before she bops back in. But she's getting on the transporter and they for once share a comment about what it was like to be assimilated. And of course, he was assimilated for a couple of days and she was assimilated for, you know, 20 years or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she's, do you ever think, you know, and she says every damn day and you're like, ooh, like it's the only time we see them really go there. And then they have the little Voyager thing. That was one of the best moments of season one. And I'm not even a big Voyager fan, but it was an awesome moment. So, yeah. So when you have that kind of a bond and a linkage, it makes sense.
Yeah.
But
all right. So quick question before we move on to the next one with Picard. So this is season three. There are only going to be three seasons. So this is going to be the end of Picard.
Right.
Given the rapid development of the franchise, like we talked about at the beginning, what do you think the chances are of us getting any more shows like this that focus on one character, the same way that we're getting with Star Wars, with Kenobi or Boba Fett or so forth.
I think you should say never again. Like, don't ever, you know, second guess. The Section 31 show, if it's not Georgiou driven, what will it be? And we could be surprised. It could be her and a huge ensemble that has as much screen time as she does. That could be a thing. I don't know if they're being really coy. I don't know if the groundswell for, a Seven and Raffi show is as in-your-face and overwhelming as the we've got to have Anson Mount as Pike in an Enterprise and you better damn well give it to us.
I don't feel that way anyway.
But it's nowhere near as big. But there is a sentiment wave out there for it. And this audio program didn't diminish any of that. I mean, it's not the same scale, but it's out there. And the one thing they did toy about saying, Alex says, yes, there are two more. Because look, Picard's wrapped. So if they really want to have the 5-10 week series and not give anybody has our paradigm shifted enough where people actually thinking I'm going to turn my Paramount Plus on this month and turn it off next month, on next month, turn it off. You know, are we still in that mode for a chunk of people? Have we evolved past that or whatever? Because if they want to have the majority of the time having a Trek on almost every week fresh, then they need to fill the Picard slot. And he's already talking about having two shows in development. If one of them is, you know, they could just be Section 31 in the Academy show, or there could be another one. And we don't know, but one of them could. Kurtzman also said he made some kind of loud tease about basically at least one of them would still have a female lead. So, I mean, there's your Seven and Raffi show at simplicity. Yeah. But who knows? They both made noises about loving to do it, but who wouldn't?
Yeah. The one I think about is, could we see Kate Mulgrew come back and do a Janeway show similar to the Picard show? Maybe not three seasons, I don't know, but at least one season. I'm wondering if they might go down this Star Wars route of having 5-10 episode miniseries, one season shows that focus on particular characters that fans really want to follow.
Well, my God, I mean, I know you're not a big fan of DS9, Chris.
No, I don't really like that show much.
But you could totally do that with Kira. You could totally do it with Bashir. You could totally do it with get Colin back and do the O'Brien. I mean, there are so many things, much less do a Klingon saga, do a Romulan, do a Tellarite saga.
I'm pretty sure we
could
do a Molly show these days. I mean, we don't know what happened to Molly.
I just had this flash. It's the Molly show. The Molly show. You never know what's happening on the Molly show. Sorry. And I'm sure Hannah would love to jump in and do that.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a happy place to be. I saw somebody speculating about how there's all this talk now with the economy the way it is and media consolidation and all the years of throwing money, you know, the Netflix bloom off the rose and people retrenching a little bit. And that's going to affect things like budgets maybe and marketing and big. But the Star Trek series are kind of self-contained, and I think they're still growing Paramount Plus, and that's the engine for their growth. And I don't think Netflix is the one that's out here throwing money at new things and movies and series and canceling them after 3 years.
Well, they're kind of throwing darts at the board and seeing what they might get to stick. Whereas
I think it's a totally different situation. Exactly. Prime and Hulu and all of that. I think they're not. I think the only thing, maybe I'm leaving somebody out aside from the BBC and Doctor Who or something, but I think the only other one is Disney with Star Wars. They've got an endless universe they could go pick from and keep that fan base happy. Mm-hmm. And again, there is so much on screen unexplored still in Star Trek to go into that we know about that we know we don't know. And we don't even think about it. Like the whole time period between Archer and Kirk, the whole time period between Kirk and Picard is sitting there waiting. You know, I will be glad. It's almost like I feel like this franchise will be really mature the day we have a series that doesn't refer to either Spock or Kirk or Picard or Data.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, and that's something I also see among fans, particularly younger fans. They want to see the franchise move beyond that. And that was sort of the reaction when Kirk showed up in the finale of Strange New Worlds.
What age bracket do you think is thinking that, Chris?
Well, just based on observations, people I've seen say that, it seems to be like people, I've noticed people in their late 20s or in their early 30s, people that didn't grow up with Kirk and Spock as being mainstream Star Trek.
Do you think I could fake it to be 30? Because that's what I've thought for 30 years. I've been so waiting to go since I saw Journey to Babel the second or third time. I have been so ready to go, you know. Hey, my Star Trek West Wing idea is, I'm still sold on that, boy. And it can be anything. It could be military. It could be diplomatic. It could be bottle show at the Federation Council. It could be off on some colony. It could be anywhere.
And I'm not criticizing people of that age who want that, because I also would like to see them move on from that. And, you know, even though Matthew and I talked on Saddle Up about how one of the things that we loved about the finale, A Quality of Mercy, is that it highlighted the importance of Kirk and Spock and Pike and the original series to the Star Trek universe. But that doesn't mean that we want them to just keep revisiting this all the time when there's so much other stuff that they could do. So,
well, and there's talk also, the Strange New World talk about running into, like, Hemmer's dead, sad. Very bold move, but sad. I wanted to hear more Enar culture, but, and thank goodness I've seen them comment it won't happen. But for the people thought, oh, and now we're going to get Scotty. I'm like, no, let Pike's crew be Pike's crew. Let them have their own time. Let's not rush. The first thing I thought of was Enterprise rushing, instead of sitting in its own time, rushing into having, you know, photon torpedoes and having better transporters and better phasers and all of that. It's like, no, let these people have their, they've got 7 years. Let's not rush headlong into it. And now I know they're going to have Lieutenant Kirk, yada, yada, and that's fine. I hope they let him have his, Paul Wesley, have his natural brown hair. If you saw the photos from Comic-Con, I don't understand why his hair was so dark, unless his hair went dark like the mood of the galaxy in future Pike's
timeline. That's what I was about to say. Like, maybe it was part of the visual aesthetic of this alternate future where things didn't quite go well and it was darker.
Anyway. I want to say one last thing about Picard. We were talking about, you know, characters and writing and all these like non-essential parts. But what I wanted to talk about just real quickly was shout out to Dave Blass, who they hired as production designer for 2 and 3, and bringing in all the legacy art folks like the Akutas and even a memory thing for Doug Drexler and Jeff Mandel, and go down the line. I'm going to leave
people out.
It made
a big difference.
Huge, but it, the feels. And it's almost like I think the season started off with a bang and all the fun. I was dreading the alternate history and the future and the alternate future and the alternate past and the alternate. But I thought it that wasn't a problem. To me, the thing, it felt like the middle was weak, where they spent half the time in the woods and half the time in the warehouse bin at the bottom of whatever that police station was. And a couple of things I didn't quite gel. It was very ambitious and didn't quite gel. But I want to do a huge shout out to the Stargazer. People thought, the history of having 4 of the Star Trek Online ships that my friend Thomas Marone designed for the game over 10 years, getting picked up and made canon. So the gamer community, that was a huge thing for them. And people just, the Stargazer just felt for a show and a half, it just felt like, oh, we're back. Not just the tech heads, but like everybody just felt like, okay, here's modern, you know, here's modern Star Trek, and then pulling in at the end. And I know the whole thing with the Borg at the end disturbed a lot of people.
Yeah,
but the idea that there's a radical Borg collective by Borg Roddy, I love the terms. You know, Borg Roddy has got her own Federation
ally. I call her Queen Agnes, but
Queen Agnes. Anyway, so there were a lot of exciting kind of funky things, anyway, there's so much in that season of Picard with the mental health aspects of his mother. There was some people might even say there was too much crammed in there, but what it was is what it was. And the idea they're going to pivot from that into this campaign with his old crew after holding back for 2 years is yes. I bring it on, bring it on. And I'm glad that the cast, who were feeling left out, I think, and envious of Jonathan and Marina, are all happy about it. So we'll see. The sad thing is that none of those people on the art and writing have a job right now with Star Trek. So maybe that will change too.
Yeah, they'll come back around.
Let's hope.
Well, the one thing that is definitely missing from these series that we've been talking about, but the next one that we're going to talk about does it the right way, is episode titles on the screen at the beginning of the episode.
Yes.
Why can't they do that? So Lower Decks, I love the fact that they make a point to put it up there. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Lower Decks. And the season 3 teaser has come out. Looks like it looks like there's going to be a lot of stuff crammed into that season. And I loved getting to see that space station that I, you know, don't care much about there as well.
Can I, so two things hit me about this trailer. Number one, it was like, oh, gang, Trek fans, remember? You got to get your freeze frame pause button finger back in shape because you're going to be right. Easter egg frame grabbing like mad again. Yeah. And it's only a 20, you do three times the number of that for a 22 minute Lower Decks as you do for a 60 minute live action show.
Yeah.
It's like they've got five times the number of stuff because it's so crammed full of funny visuals. You know, not just funny, but obscure thing. Wait, what's that alien species? Is that species from that fourth season show of DS9 that was the, you know? No, it's back there in the back. They've done it. But yes, I have to say the tag little scene, the teaser with a tag or the promo with a tag. Let's just leisurely circle the pylons.
Yeah.
And then they go into the mock. I just died laughing because it was a combination of, they went to all that trouble to recreate the whole thing with the, oh, look, it's one of, suddenly the Cerritos is one of those anonymous ships circling around the pylons that you saw every week. And then they blow open the wormhole right on cue. Just, but the fact that they were also meta making fun of it in a loving way.
Right.
I just laughed. The first four times I saw that, I just bust out laughing. And I thought of you and all the Niner fans that I've known who I hope would not be offended. I was laughing in the family way.
Oh, I don't think anyone would be offended.
I was laughing with it, not at it. Yeah. So,
no, it was great.
The same way I was laughing and smiling at the silhouette of the back of Cybok's head.
Yeah.
I was just like, okay, we're going to do this. Okay, we're going to do in Strange New Worlds. We're going to do this. Okay. Where were you 3 years ago when they were screaming about Michael being made up canon? Yes, 1989 says hold my beer.
But if they did that on Lower Decks, it would be the same scene from Strange New Worlds, the back of Cybok's head and silhouette. But next to him would be that like weird guy in the desert that's like looking up and he's in awe of Cybok next to Cybok on the horse. That would be the Lower Decks version of that same scene.
Yeah. John Berryman, I think. Yeah. Who once upon a time was the alien console water wiper. In Starfleet headquarters in 4. Yeah. Only years before, he'd been a capable alien, and there he was living on desert. Yes.
I do love that Starfleet has a booth at some kind of job fair.
Well, I always thought that might have been like the campus club fair until I saw, oh, Starfleet Embassy. Okay. It's not the campus, you know, it's not like the opening scene of Pitch Perfect or something. It's... Yeah. And the archaeologist next door looking very Vashi, or Vashi, as they meant to pronounce it. Yeah.
And also, this storyline heading into a new season kind of mirrors the storyline we're going to get heading into Strange New World season 2, where we have a main character who has been arrested to end the season.
I must say, that was the biggest downer of all Strange New Worlds. Why did they have to just outright copy their animated little brother? Or sister. I'm just aghast. Aghast, I say.
Okay. Now, I also have to ask you about this news that there's going to be a Lower Decks, Strange New Worlds crossover. Are they actually going to mix live action and animation, or are they going to bring some of the actors from Lower Decks into the show live?
Okay. I have to say something. Not from anybody big, but from somebody within the bowels of production, I had been tipped off to this like about a couple months ago. And I knew it happens. It happens like well into the season, like halfway, two thirds.
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw them announcing it here, I was a little bit in shock. I'm like, wow, really? You're not going to, they're not going to unspool until what, a year from now? Yeah, strange. It's on Strange New Worlds, not on Lower Decks. So it'll be next May, June. If they are really like about a year apart, you know, it could be this time next year before we see this. But they're already letting that out, which was amazing. But I didn't know all the details. I did know, as they said on Saturday, that it would be Tawny Newsome. And I always want to say Jack Boimler, Jack Quaid, live action.
Is that because, like, Tim Apple, the CEO of Apple?
Yeah, Tim Apple. It would be, I mean, that's a case where they're voice actors, but they've also done live action acting. So it's not a stretch to have the real voice in real life. And they drew the characters, you know, in many ways to look like the actual voice actors, which has been a help. Now I want to go back and ask Mike, if that was no, we knew at the beginning we were going to do live action crossovers. So we wanted the characters to look like the real life actors. What I didn't get was the fact that they're going to have animated segments too. So whether it'll be like Black and White, Kansas, and Color Oz, only animation and live action, there'll be live action Mariner and Boimler in live action. But here's the thing, Chris, no one has said this. I started a little 5-10 minute short commentary every week. I just started this week, called Second Opinion. But one of the things that, like, nobody has realized is, what year does Strange New Worlds happen in? We established?
A Strange New Worlds is like 2256, yeah. Right?
60. You're doing that on purpose. 2259, 2260, maybe by second season.
Yeah, by second season.
What year does Lower Decks happen? Like circa, Picard's now in 2401. 23, I know, it's the century, it's the ordinal.
Around 2380, yeah, 24, end of the 24th century.
My point is, Strange New Worlds and Lower Decks, just on the surface, they are 120 years apart. So forget live action and animation, just to get them together, you're going to have to bridge somehow. Now, it would be the cheat of the century if it's, say, Lower Deckers walking into a holodeck and there's a malfunction and everybody's, you know, like Riker going back to look at Archer's ship, you know, that would be the cheat of the century. And I don't think that's what they're, I think there's some kind of something happening to put them there. But it's, again, it's not just the animation live action. You've got a 120 year gap to bridge here. If it's real, you got to have some great, good old temporal vortex kind of thing happen.
Orb
or
of
somebody
time,
dig
Larry.
Out a, you know, or an orb of time or something.
Orb of what? Time.
Yeah. Simplest. Yeah. Simplest non-technobad. You don't have to tech the tech at all. You just have to orb the orb.
Yeah. Just orb the orb.
Orb the orb. That's a new one. I just made that up. But
it'll be interesting.
All the hubbub about this, I've been amazed that no one has stopped to think about that. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
That is interesting. It'll be interesting to see if they can do it. My initial understanding was that, yeah, they're going to be animated. There's going to be some animation in a Strange New Worlds episode, which on my initial reaction is, I really don't want to see that. I think it would work better for Lower Decks to have a little bit of live action in it than for Strange New Worlds to have a little bit of animation in it. However, I think episodes like Spock Amok and the Elysian Kingdom show that Strange New Worlds, by the nature of its format, they can play around in a way that might make this work. And when we see it, we might think, yeah, that was kind of clever. That worked okay.
I was going to say, Chris, if you're going to stand on the lawn and yell about this, what have we learned so far? Look how everybody has been constantly surprised by comedy and animation and the wacky envelope pushing that that Strange New World has done, that Lower Decks has been, that Prodigy's been. So it's like, never say never.
Yeah, so it might work. We'll just have to wait and see.
It might work. Listen to you. Okay.
Well, when you orb an orb, anything is possible, Larry.
When you orb an orb, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. in brackets, not in parentheses, but it has to be brackets.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Lower Decks, we've talked about a little bit earlier and in the past how it's helped the franchise and you bring people back mm-hmm. in. Now, Prodigy is interesting to me because I wrote on the outline for you, supposedly aimed at kids, but obviously written for adults who grew up on Voyager. That's how I feel about Prodigy, having watched it. I think it's a wonderful gateway for kids to get into mm-hmm. Star Trek, but it's really very much, I feel, aimed at people who grew up on Voyager and love Voyager. And it's, you can enjoy it as an adult just as much as you can as a kid.
Are you saying the people who had Trek-ready kids are all the Voyager people and like the Niners did not grow up to have kids who are Trek adjacent?
I'm not sure, but I mean, take me for example. You know, my kids are grown now, but when my kids were little, even though they lived with me as such a diehard Star Trek fan, I have never been able to get my kids interested in Star Trek. And so I think there are a lot of Star Trek fans who are like that, who have kids who are young mm-hmm. today, and they want to share Star Trek with their kids, but their kids just aren't into it, in part because the source material, most of it now, especially the stuff that you would let your young kids watch, because you're not going to let your young kids watch season two of Picard or some of the stuff happening on Discovery, I think, if they're mm-hmm. very young. Whereas you might let them watch The Next Generation or Voyager. That's sort of an obstacle. But I think Prodigy is like this gift being given to these fans who are parents, who they now have something to show their children and bring their children in. But it's something that they can watch and love it just as much.
Yeah, but I think really early on, you know, and I sit down with my granddaughter, you know, Cadet Alice, and we have a video series that I've got one to post. We're not through the first season yet because we do one about every 2 months. But mm-hmm. we watch a show off camera and then come and sit and talk with it. And she's scary sometimes, both about her TV presence and also her little, about the time I think she's like kind of glazed over, then she pops out with something like, yeah, why did Gwen's father want to leave her behind? You should never leave your kids behind. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, yes, very good. The funny thing about Prodigy, I think people, you know, I think Lower Decks pioneered the way for people. Intentional or not, the gripey old man on the lawn bit here. Lower Decks pioneered people to accept Star Trek in animation. Now, it's Adult Swim, it's snarky animation, and having said that, I'm broad-brushing here because we've all seen now, there are character arcs, there mm-hmm. is Athos, yeah. even through the filter of Lower Decks, there's character bits, and there's canon building, and they're going to be, and Mike McManus said they're going to keep adding into the canon, because they're in a very busy, dense time in the timeline, that post-Voyager, a few years before Picard, you know, and Prodigy and Lower Decks are just a couple of years apart and mm-hmm. different arenas, obviously. But
right.
So there are, and what's really fascinating is I missed the first talk of this, but now the showrunners talk about every couple of months they have a showrunners meeting where I guess Michelle and Mike and the Hagemans and Aaron Waelke maybe on and Akiva and Henry Alonzo Myers, they all sit down and make sure that, I mean, Discovery is way off in the future, but they probably listen to see what's a historical relevant that's coming up. Anyway, they all make sure and stay in each other, out of each other's way, but also in sync when they can, or if they bring up a historical thing that they all are treating it the same way. But I think the biggest surprise about Prodigy after Lower Decks kind of cleared the field for accepting, air quoting, animation, Star Trek, is that people said, okay, well, it's the kids' show, and whether people were excited to set their kids down and watch it with them, or whether a lot of people concerned about the franchise, like I am, I have a granddaughter, but even, you know, they're not sitting here with me right now, to sit down and see how this is going to appeal to kids and watch the first pilot and go, the first hour and go, well, this sure starts off really Star Warsy, and then it shifts into a Starfleet mode, and then mm-hmm. you go, Oh, was that part of the master plan to take the kids from where they might start off be and suck them along? You know, like this is what they're used to seeing, spacey science fiction.
Yeah.
They're not used to gleaming starships and cool tech gadgets, but this is, you know. But whatever the case was, I think there is a ton of adult demo. There's a ton of adult viewers who sat down to see what the kids are going to watch and is it going to work out of curiosity and totally got sucked in. Yeah. And especially if they get past that hour and thinking, oh, this is looking kind of Star Wars-y. But by the second, and Janeway pops up, you know, with the Federation national anthem and a flag and the Starfleet banner and starts cheering for everybody and giving the basic lessons of what Star Trek is all about. And you got graphics showing all the core Federation species and the seals. And I realized that the Tellarites have an emblem now, and I didn't realize that. And now it's all over Discovery. And Tim Peel, the graphics person, is awesome, and he's my new hero for most of the franchise. You very quickly realize that, and just the really smart, even though it's geared down for kids, it's not insulting and it's not patronizing and pandering,
yeah,
and
right.
It's certainly not juvenile. And yes, I think the only thing more shocking that people fell in love with Lower Decks is the fact that people are totally absorbed, adults of all ages, are totally absorbed in Prodigy.
Yeah.
Because it feels canonistic. It feels.
Yeah, exactly.
And the longer it's gone on, the more you get. And when they're bopping back and forth between the Beta and the Delta Quadrant and talking about where they are. And I will just say this. I forget which episode it is, but the time loop, the very simple time, we're not crossing centuries.
Yeah.
But that time anomaly one in the moment, where the closer you were to the apex, the faster your time loop was.
Right.
But they had the graphic that showed the faces of everybody and where they were in the time loop disturbance. That was the most amazing visualization that cut through all the confusion about what they'd been, you know, techno-babbling about. They weren't orbing the orb. They were stuck in something. And the fact that you were on a show for kids, that they visualized the temporal trap eight ways or however, five, six ways. And then it made total sense that everybody got it. Alice got it. She's six.
Yeah.
I mean, that was amazing. That's one of the most amazing things I've seen in any Star Trek. So yes, Prodigy. Yeah. The only thing that's sad about Prodigy is I feel like they're, I hate to say this, they're dicking around with it, with this 10 and 10 and 10 and 10 rollout. I hate to see that. I feel like Fox treating Firefly out of the gate that way.
Is that because they need the time for production and they didn't start, they rolled it out maybe earlier than they should have? Or is it just a programming decision?
I think it was I think the first delay they got caught up on, and it was partly COVID. And it's like, my God, they have 2 years to hear them say they need 2 years an episode. But I think some of that was the original R&D. They had to, you know, develop the characters and the settings. Yeah. But this second wave is just crazy. And I feel like it's become their filling to get them through the gaps. I feel sorry for everybody involved that they're
so
having
like
to wait
in between
so
the
long.
Other series.
Because they've done 40 episodes. They've worked on them. When I saw Dan Hageman and Aaron Waelke at Mission Chicago in April. And they said then we were just talking at my booth, and they said they had just finished writing the 40th episode.
I see.
And they're like the live action shows that go in prep and then writing and then staging and then post in live action. They're all over the map. I think Aaron said over to somebody over in some interview the last few days that they've got the next, you know, whatever, 20 episodes, whatever. They're all in different phases because of animation. I still keep trying to wrap my head around how this works systematically.
I see.
But they're in all phases of, you know, production.
Mm, that's interesting. You know, that graphic that you're talking about that clarifies all the techno babble and shows where the people are, I imagine that probably came about because of Janeway. She's probably like, you know, back when I was on the ship in the Delta Quadrant, when Harry was back there and then Tuvok and Balana and all them, and it's just techno babble all the time, and my head was about to explode. And I said, if I'm ever in charge of a starship again, I'm going to make sure that any discussion comes with an easy to understand graphic.
Chris, you don't want one thing you do not want is a hologram with a headache.
That's right.
That's all I'm saying. So yes.
The other thing I was going to say about Prodigy, though, is that, as you said, yes, I think there are a lot of fans who are there for it because it feels familiar and like canon. But I also think that there are a lot of fans who are just there for the Janeway. They're like, I'm here for the Janeway.
You're right.
And that little blue sluggy guy, he's kind of cute too, but I'm here for the Janeway.
I think that's a great, I like the way you put it. Yeah, I'm here for the Janeway. And may I say, some of them are probably there for the Chakotay Janeway and wondering where that's going. But can I just say that we had not just one, and there's a mystery, and apparently they're going to get started getting into more of their backstories, because there's some really bizarre, these aliens that we have not seen, Dal and Gwyn both, and mm-hmm. at least Gwyn's is named, and she's a clone of her dad, who's the last survivor, as well as being the big bad. But the fact that real Janeway is going to be the big bad, because she's going to be chasing them in the ship now, but the fact that there's some of the Alpha Quadrant races in the Delta, which shows how far things have come along, and they're going to get in the background of Jaglom Pog, and like, why is a Tellarite stuck, you know, as a kid, a slave miner in the, and it's not the far, it's not the Ocampa Kazon Delta. It's like right over the Beta Line.
Yeah.
It's like the, I was back home. It's like, it's the Gainesville of Texas right over the Oklahoma line. That's going
to make
explained.
So much sense to so many of our listeners, Larry.
No. Get a map. Learn some geography, people. That's because that's such an important corner of the world to have geography lessons over. No, I mean, the fact that not just that, but the Tellarite doctor on Chakotay's ship is a Tellarite. We're going to have two named speaking Tellarites, and they're different. You know, Jaglom's kind of a, I saw people talking about, why does he have, he's a kid, teenager, why does he have chin hair? Well, Tellarites must obviously have facial hair. My old thing about, you know, like the biker Tellarites with the tusks that we've been having, especially in the modern shows. But if you notice, I think I could be wrong, but I think he at least has normal Journey to Babel hair. The doctor at the back of Janeway's ship, I got called out for saying Chakotay's ship. Real Janeway ship, along with her Andorian, first officer and her Trill navigator, I think. Mm-hmm. That's, we're going to have two Tellarites, regular name characters, eventually in the same show. What's really got me though is, and what this has brought, where Prodigy is, somewhere, like it was not until I was filming on Star Trek Continues that I found out that McCoy's fan base had finally started to catch up to Kirk and Spock. I had all these young people on our crew telling me that McCoy was their favorite character, mainly women, mainly some of our younger girls and young women. And I was like, you don't have to tell me that just because I'm playing McCoy. And they're like, no, McCoy is really our favorite character. And I just felt bad for Dee because he used to laugh about when he found out, when I told him I was a fan, he's like, well, where were you with the years I needed you? I had to put up with Leonard and Bill. And that's so now suddenly, apparently, there are Tellarite fans coming out of the closet. And I saw Aaron Walkey defending, like somebody did a grid of now, some of them are just obscure, all the different Tellarites that have like popped up as a token Tellarite extra in the background mm-hmm. of a scene since day one, since Journey to Babel, kind of fending off the thing and said, well, my God, we've had Klingons all over the place. This is species, like tusks or not, and hair or not, or even. The fact that Jankum is a tripedal, is a tridigited Tellarite. Throwback to, you know.
Well, Larry, I like to think that all this love for Tellarites now, it all started with your riveting performance as a dead Tellarite on the floor and Continues.
I'll take that, Chris. I'll take it. If I can be the herald of the Tellarite respect revolution, hashtag time for Teller Prime, then I will take that. I will take that all the way to whatever the hell the Tellarite equivalent of Stovacore is.
All right. So, yeah, well, hopefully Prodigy will be rolled out in a more timely manner moving forward.
Yes. Because they certainly have ambitious plans. And if you heard this recent interview or saw the recent interview with Aaron Walkey, he is talking about they're very cognizant of the fact that where they are in the timeline, and they're like about to bump up against, you know, everything from the events of Lower Decks, what they might get into if they're interrupting things happening, mm-hmm. to creeping into the years. First of all, being cognizant that the kids are going to get older, and eventually, I think he said something like, "Well, the show should end with all of them going to the real Starfleet Academy in a few years, or whatever." Mm-hmm. That's, you know, who knows. But being cognizant of the fact that the Romulan, you know, the whole Romulan sun supernova known in advance, and Spock and the jellyfish and the and Picard's, you know, refugee movement and all that, and failure, that's all going to be on the horizon too. So I don't know how much longer the diviner, you know, the bad evil dad, clone dad, is going to be part of the main thrust, and how much they'll get into other plots. But they're all, the bottom line is they're all cognizant of that, and they're all being very smart about it. So we'll see.
Well, having Prodigy end with all the kids going off to the real Starfleet Academy would be a great way to segue into a live action Starfleet Academy series.
There you go. And
Paramount.
What if the Starfleet Academy series live action is Superintendent Janeway or something? I'm just throwing that out. I'm still the one who wants new characters and new corners of the timelines. I don't mean Kelvin. I mean, show us parts in the chronology that we haven't explored yet, temporally. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a good transition to our last topic here before we wrap up, which is Discovery.
Oh, yeah, Discovery. There's nothing new to say. Okay. Nice show, Chris. Let's...
We've already talked about Discovery a lot, especially early in our discussion.
Probably more than it deserves. Oh, no, I didn't say that.
Larry. But they are exploring a time period that has never been explored
far
future.
Yes.
So, looking at season 5, I don't know, what are your hopes for it? Because for me, like season 4, I thought the story was pretty interesting overall. But at the end of season 3, I thought, oh, they have an opportunity now to transition into a more traditional Star Trek format where they're helping rebuild the Federation. Mm-hmm. But instead, we got another, you know, it's galactic.
Yeah,
galaxy's going to end kind of thing. Not like some of the other ones.
Yeah.
And I actually thought that the concept of the 10C was interesting. The resolution of how they communicated and figured it out with them, it just felt like, we don't have any time left, so let's just kind of wrap this up and everybody just figures it out. And
well, I will say that it was interesting. It was kind of predictable and very Star Trek, going back to the Horda, although the Horda did it in an hour, not 10 hours. Yeah. But the idea of your big bad for the season, big mystery, winds up being something totally innocent. That was Star Trek-ish. Mm-hmm. The ending where they have the first contact with it, and it's, what, chemical pheromones of mood or something?
Yeah.
Figuring that out on the planet, on the dead planet, was really, I thought that was one of their finest hours. Watching the team work on something that the Universal Translator couldn't deal with. They had to totally go out of the box and get into other, you know, landscapes and paradigms of thought and use senses that we don't normally link up together and find a way to depict it and work on it and work on it as a team. I thought that was all awesome. And then they had the visuals, and they got to use their AV wall or whatever it is. And, you know, so everybody gets to talk about how incredible that was. And I thought that was fine. The ending did kind of feel a little weird. And remember, all these series we've been talking about, we're all dealing with COVID. And there are times in Discovery season, like the one of the visual effects people. Remember the scene earlier? I'm sorry I'm jumping around, but I want to make sure I say this. The scene where Zora the computer, they worry about... Stamets is convinced it's going to go evil computer, or he's going to have a PTSD back to the control AI. And everybody else, all the representing people, you know, like Adira and, I started to say Adira in blue, Gray and Adira. And then Kovic is trying to be the reasonable person here from the future.
Yeah.
And they're all trying to resolve this. And then they're talking to Zora like it's Hal or something out of 2001. Mm-hmm. But Zora is being very reassuring and never steps out of line. And you keep waiting for the shoe to fall where Zora says, ha, 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 I've got you all now. And it never happens. And then they finally just decided to make her a we've got dolphins. Why not have, you know, why not have the computer be a, you know, and now you're on the road to that short trek.
Yeah.
But filming the scene, here's what's amazing. They had, this is an encapsulation of what they had to deal with to get these shows done. So there were, what, four actors in the scene? Okay. There's the actors playing Stamets and Kovic and Adira and Tal. And then they have the interactive hologram that Zora is putting up, and they're looking at things and analyzing. Okay. Because of COVID and because of time schedules, that took 3 months to film that scene with four different directors, because not all the actors, none of the four actors were in the room at the same time.
That's incredible. Yeah.
And then, Tim Peel, who was doing the effect that they were all, you know, they were all jointly poking on and Zora and looking at and reconfiguring, he had to make that happen from snippets of film. So when people would, they had to kind of orient where everyone's standing in the room and where they're facing. But it's like the old days, we were laughing about this. It's like the old days when somebody would fire a phaser and at a target, and then the animator had to draw the beam, mm-hmm. but the beam didn't make sense going from the phaser to the person.
Right.
Yeah. So the face, it's like you're holding your phaser straight out, but the beam goes down at a 45 degree angle because it has to, and you can't, there's no way other way to fix it. So it's just a weird phaser angle. Well, this was like times 100.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to literally design the thing they're interacting with based on where everyone is standing and when there would be a blooper. Like 1 minute you're here, but now you're looking that direction and walking this way, but you just thought you were here. So it's like he had to design that thing they were interacting with based on the live action performance, mm-hmm. which was all pieced together from three different directors over 4 months, or four directors over 3 months, or something insane. So that's, as we critique all these shows, that's a thing this year.
Something to keep in mind.
So next year, what they're filming now, they're probably got some kind of a protocol going on, but it can't be as severe as it was.
Right.
So it'll be interesting. Yeah. But at the same time, a lot of people said, did you notice there were a lot of like two-person calm character moments that maybe didn't exist before on Discovery? And that was good. A bonus of the COVID?
Yeah, that's a bonus. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, it's just been, but those are all things that people don't know. We barely know now. As the years go by, we'll get into that more, but it's a mm-hmm. thing too. But I just, the finale, when they're all standing on the fantail of the, they've all just like walked up to the edge of the shuttle bay on the fantail, and they're all just standing there in their nice little straight, socially distanced straight lines. That got a little, you know, and then the TARDIS comes up to them, and then it goes away, and then it comes up, and then it goes away.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But that wasn't as bad. I mean, to me, the human element, Tarka, that was the disappointment for me. It started off great, and then I just thought, you know, and it was only like Tig Notaro back there snarking it up. I thought, save that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, for me,
it's hard to bring that off.
It is. But I think that series has been getting better, you know, each season as it goes along.
Yes.
I was a little bit disappointed when I thought that they were going to have an opportunity to rebuild the Federation and kind of be these people from the past, from the glory days of the Federation, who found their way to the future, and now they can help bring everyone together. And I guess they're doing it in some small ways, like bringing Navarre into the Federation. But I think maybe my expectation for the series is just different than what the writers and the producers are wanting to do with the series, which is that I'm wanting something that's a little more grounded
in
Star Trek universe that we've known for all this time, and for the messages behind that, and the exploration of the human condition behind that, which they do in some respects. But I just still feel that plot is driving that show too much, and that character is in the backseat too far. And I hope that will change in season 5, but I'm not expecting it to. And of course, I'm looking forward to seeing it. But, you know, it is, as I tell people, it is the series that has given us all this other stuff that many people are loving, because it's the one that reignited the franchise on television.
Can Can I ask a question, Chris?
Yes.
Is it Discovery, or would that have been whatever the first show was they chose to do?
Well, of course, Larry. Of course. But
my point is, because here's, so I want to say first off that third season,
yeah,
what you're saying there about seeing rebuilding the Federation and all that, mm-hmm. I thought that the first two episodes were really a great combination of kind of Star Trek Unshackled, because they were the first two in this new century that we didn't know, and our point of view characters, which we only had one of in the first hour, Michael, and mm-hmm. then we had the rest of the ship. But we, them as our point of view, they were in a, for once we were all on the same page together, and that was scary and spooky and unsettling, especially when we had Lurians and Andorians and Orions and Tellarites run, and Vulcans running around that seemed familiar, but they weren't, because they were 800 years out of whack,
mm-hmm.
right? And gradually you hear about this burn thing, which is very big and scary, and oh my God. And also reflective of about three of the pitches, including Dave Rossi's animated series during the Fallow Times.
Yeah.
Like some big cataclysm has happened and everything is disrupted, and our heroes aren't sailing proudly on a beauty ship. They're on a ship trying to rebuild the past glory, and that will be their glory. And that's mm-hmm. kind of where Discovery took this season. And my favorite episodes, the anomalies were the first two. But then once you kind of got a grounding, my favorite episodes were exactly what you said. Going to Earth and helping them like not be morons. Like, really, guys? You couldn't scan that these are actually humans out here all the right. way out at Jupiter? You
they
couldn't
tricked
tell?
You. They tricked you with that helmet.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. But even more so than that, having the Vulcan-Romulan reunification
mm-hmm.
was amazing. And then going yeah. to Trill was amazing. Yeah. And they were all serving the plot. I get it. But those three in a row, I was like, oh, wow. If this is what the thrust of the season is going to be, this is awesome. Because it's like, we're 800, 900 years in the future. Let's see all the knowns that we know about. Let's see. Let's get updated. Let's update those files, kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it got back into the alien kid that screamed at the wrong place at the wrong time, I was like, oh, well. But those three episodes I loved. And that's also, you know, where, and I've gone blank on her character name, but now Saru's love interest came.
Yeah.
From
the
that.
President of Navarre, yeah.
Right, right, right. And reuniting Michael with her mother in the weirdest of places and having her be a Kawat Navat.
Yeah.
You know, tying in with Picard. I mean, there were a lot of interesting bits out of it, but I just still my big picture with Discovery is it was the troubled show that had a troubled DNA in chaos. Mm-hmm. It was the first one, and you could technically say that everything spun out of it, but I'm going to say that the first one was not going to be allowed to fail, just like Discovery was not allowed to fail. And by fail, I mean a chaotic birth that you don't pull the plug on because it's Star Trek and the world is watching. We've got to launch this whole damn new corporate enterprise and jump into the new century of media. So it cannot, you know, failure is not an option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, less than stellar excellence might be, but failure is not an option. And we will get down the road. We will land the plane and get down the road and get better as we go along.
Well,
which they've done. But
as Bill McNeil from News Radio would have said, adequacy will be great. Being adequate, it's, you know, adequate.
But, you know, and it has gotten better. And,
yeah,
you know. And there were bits of having all yeah. those people voting with the graphics and getting graphics for, I'm sorry, now my canon brain is on overtime. There's been so much awesome stuff
yeah.
graphic-wise yeah. in the future done too. But
yeah. So we'll see where season five goes.
I've heard one hint about a plot from season five, and I don't want to be shot, that if it's true, harkens back to a canon corner of the Star Trek universe that is very much there but has barely been touched. And I don't know if it's the big part of the season or it's like a subplot of the season, but it will be curious and interesting to see what they do with it.
This doesn't have anything to do with Grudge having a connection to Spot and then Spot's spontaneous gender change in Genesis.
Wow. Right? You have the same sources I do, Chris. That's amazing.
No. All right. Well, we've talked about all the series, so that's where we are with Star Trek.
And We're not going to talk about the Berman era now, in hindsight?
The Berman
all 18
era.
Years?
I thought we had just buried the Berman era. Like, it just didn't exist, you know, because it was so
we'll destroy and... franchise for food. Okay.
All right, Larry. So, as we close out here, as always, what do you have going on? What do you have coming up? Where should people go?
Oh, well, LarryNemechek.com. And it's not too late to do this. If anyone is headed to Trek Vegas, come the day before. We're about 2 weeks away from closing out this the window on this. But because Trek Vegas is at the end of August, not the early part of August, we have our one-day trip to the Valley of Fire that I'm doing for Geek Nation Tours. But also, and that's at geeknationtours.com. But if you come to LarryNemechek.com for everything, I've got a link to that. Also to a special Gene Roddenberry Life Origins tour around LA for 2 days. You can click on that. That's the weekend before Vegas, like the 20th and 21st. Supposed to happen last year for the centennial. Got bumped for COVID. Hopefully we will not be shut down another month here. But that's awesome. I'm just about at making, it'll be a small group. I've only got about 4 spots left. So check that out. Everything at LarryNemechek.com. And of course we've got Trek Vegas. And of course, you don't even have to wait for an event. Anytime you're in LA and you want to do your own location tour, your own away mission, I'm happy to do a Trekland Treks with you. And that's at TreklandTreks.com. We will lead you around. You plan the sites. I'll work it out with you. And we'll have a wonderful day of it. As always, Trekland Tuesdays Live is Tuesday at 1 Pacific, 4 Eastern, and 9 UK and 10 Central Europe. And we have folks, everything I try to do, I've got folks around the world, even live. And of course, Portal 47 is going. Portal47.net, you'll get there. And everything Trekland. And this new, you know, YouTube, I got into it late. Everybody, please go and like and subscribe my YouTube channel. And
Hit
that bell. Ding. And Gabriel or otherwise. No, wait, don't hit Gabriel Bell. It's really Cisco. Don't do that. But the new thing, it's just a little 5-10 minute thing I'm going to do every week, especially when we have new episodes dropping, is called Dr. Trek's Second Opinion. And it'll be just a little nugget. It won't be buried in the podcast. It won't be buried in my Tuesday Live, even though I do a half hour YouTube edit. It'll be like a quick reaction, just fanish gushing. I say that. Something new we're doing. Oh, and of course I'd better mention the Trek Files from Roddenberry as well, my weekly podcast.
It's too bad you just don't do anything, Larry. That's why you're always here in the ready room when I come back. You just
I'm trying. It's because I've passed out from exhaustion on your orange sofa.
You need to start doing some stuff. But all right. Well, everyone check that out. And if you'd like to hear more from me elsewhere on the network, I mentioned some of the shows in our discussion today. Matthew Rushing and I do quite a few shows together these days. We just finished Saddle Up, where we went through every episode of Strange New Worlds. Before that, we did The Artificial Tango, which used to be called The Line. That is about Star Trek Picard, and Matthew and I went through season 2 of Picard together. And of course, we do The Orb. We've been doing The Orb now for, I don't know how long, 8, 9, 10 years, talking about Deep Space Nine. So Larry's picking on me today.
You do a whole podcast about something you don't care about? That's interesting.
Well, that's what makes it fascinating, Larry, is that, you know, we just talk about a show that we just really don't like. And in fact, we dislike that show so much, when we get to the end, we just start another rewatch. It's just some kind of like, what do they call that? Sadomasochism or something like that? I don't know.
Yeah, you never thought about just circling around the pylons?
That's what I do when I'm asleep. I just see that in my head, yeah. So you can hear us talk about Deep Space Nine on The Orb. And also, Matthew and I are doing a 20th anniversary rewatch of Enterprise. And we're about maybe a third of the way through season 2 right now. That's on Warp 5. So if you'd like to go back through Enterprise with us, we're going one episode at a time. And we are trying not to talk ahead very much. So we're just kind of following it as we would if we were watching straight through. So that's
you're taking the long road.
We're taking the long road, getting from there to here.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And then you can find me in many episodes in the back catalog, of course. And if you'd like to chat, you can find me in social media. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's my username everywhere in social media, but Twitter is where I am most active, and I'd love to hear from you there. If you'd like to share some feedback on today's show, there are many ways to do that, but perhaps the best way to do that is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right up. If not, just type the whole name, the Babel Conference. It is a closed group for listeners, so if you're joining for the first time, please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so I can let you in, and you'll see a post there on the timeline for this episode of The Ready Room, and you can share your comments with fellow listeners and with me, and Larry's in there as well, so you can get Larry's feedback also.
I'm trapped. I can't get out.
Yes.
You're in the refrigerator, right? The one where people post photos of themselves and their merch and everything. So,
just in there chilling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, you can send email if you go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that'll come to me by email. And if the podcast app you use allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that as well. And if you'd like to help us keep all the shows, everything that we're doing in the network going, we could definitely use your help through Patreon. If you'd like to find out how to become involved in the network, just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to find out how. And I'd like to send a huge thank you to everyone who is supporting us right now. We would not be here without you. Thank you very, very much. Well, Larry, we have to get back on mic together sooner next time. And
then 47 weeks of new Star Trek. Yes.
I think it may have been. But at least there's no shortage of Star Trek stuff to talk about these days.
Well, Chris, looks like it's time to stick a Klingon beard dye applicator in it, because the Ready Room is done.